south of the Mason-Dixon. This is the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. Here is your host, Brian McClanahan.
Welcome back to the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. This is your host, Brian McClanahan, and this is episode 245, covering the week of January 11th through January 22nd, 2021. Glad to have you back on the program. Very glad to be here. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter, like our Facebook page, and subscribe to our YouTube page. You can find all those social media accounts at our webpage, abbevilleinstitute.org. That's ABBEVILLE, institute.org. While you're there, give us an email address. We'll give you a free ebook, Exploring the Southern Tradition. It's a book of 20 essays by 20 Abbeville Institute scholars. It is a great book, and it's free to you if you simply give us an email address. And of course, with that, you'll get our daily dose of Dixie, Monday through Friday. It's a great way to keep in touch with the Institute. You might get some other emails from us here and there, but that is our primary communication method. Also, while you're there, click on that Amazon Smile button. If you shop at Amazon, you can help support the Institute. Every time you purchase something at Amazon, you throw a few pennies our way. So it's a great way to support the Institute. While you're at abbevilleinstitute.org, also click on that support tab at the top of the page. You can donate monthly, annually, or a one-time gift. We exist on your generous contributions alone. So if you like what we do, if you like the podcast, the website, our conferences, we've got a lot of great stuff going on. Our videos, I'll talk about one of those again. Please consider a tax-deductible donation to the Institute. It does keep the lights on, and it does help us in our mission to explore what is true and valuable in the Southern tradition. Also, we have our conference coming up next week. It is full, but there's a great side to that. We have now created, and it will be available in short order, the Abbeville Academy. So if you miss any of these Zoom conferences that we're doing, you can pick them up on the back end on our new Abbeville Academy. Now, the website for that will be abbevilleacademy.org. It is not live yet, but it will be live within the next few days, in the next week or so. So while you're thinking about trying to get an education, trying to get this outside education, trying to work outside the mainstream education apparatus, you can think about Abbeville Academy. So this is another thing that we're doing now. And of course, your donations go and help promote that. We've got all kinds of cool stuff. Don't forget to download our free mobile application. Just look for it at your app store. You know, share our material around on social media. I know other people are using other social media sites now besides Facebook and Twitter, and we're looking into that too. So just think about getting the word out. This is all we ask you to do. Now, this podcast, as I said, covers 2 weeks because, unfortunately, I was not able to podcast last week. So I'm going to cover both weeks' material, and they all work together in a lot of ways. I mean, look, everything we do works together, and we're in such dangerous times in America. You know, we just had a new president inaugurated, and the very first step essentially was to double down on some things that I think are highly suspect, and so do a lot of the people that follow us, but, you know, the anti-Southern bias is out there. Even if you look at the 1776 Project, and by the way, we're potentially working on our own with that, but if you look at the 1776 Project, and you look at the anti-Southern bias in that, it's a complete attack on John C. Calhoun. And so when you have friends like that, and we've talked about that on this podcast before, when you have friends like that out of conservatives who are so anti-Southern in their biases, I mean, where do you go from there? How do you work with that? And how do you form alliances with people that simply despise your traditions, despise the impact the South has had on American culture and society? If you're looking at now the attack on, for example, the filibuster, which is one of the procedures that the Senate adopted over the years, the attack on the filibuster. Well, now that's considered to be a Southern relic that has to go because it's racist. I mean, these are the things that the left is doing. Everything that's bad in America is from the South. And this is why the Abbeville Institute exists, because we want to talk about what is true and valuable in this. Where does the Southern tradition work? I mean, the Southern tradition offers something to America. And what is that? Well, one of the things I thought, we had a great piece a couple of weeks ago from Casey Chalk. And it was about, well, I'll read the title to you, because it's such a good piece, such a nice discussion. It's a Southern critique of radical chic, right? So it's a piece about Tom Wolfe, the great literary figure Tom Wolfe, from the South, by the way. He's a Southerner. But he was talking about the hypocritical stupidity of Northern elites in the 1970s and 60s and how stupid this actually was back then and how stupid it is today. You look at what's happening in America today, there's this radical chic. It's okay to cozy up to Antifa or some of the other, you know, far left organizations because that's hip. That's happening. They're against things. They're against things we're against. In this particular piece, Tom Wolfe was talking about how all these stupid New York elites were cozying up to the Black Panthers, who were in no way in line with these people. But yet, because it's radical, because they're against the right, these are people we got to support. And I find all this funny because, I mean, there's nothing new that's going on right now that hasn't gone on before. It's just that now it's mainstream. It's gone mainstream to be radical chic. You look at Bernie Sanders and all the attention paid to Bernie Sanders and his during the inaugural where he had on some mittens and he was sitting in a chair. Look cozy. I mean, this is the funny thing. Bernie Sanders, the guy that honeymooned in the Soviet Union, right? Somehow he's radical chic now. It's fun to love Bernie Sanders. It's fun to love Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, which we have a piece about her in this particular group of pieces for these last couple of weeks. But it's fun to love these things. It's fun to cozy up to terrorists, essentially. Thugs. Because they have the right position on things. But if you go on the other side, those people need to have razor wire and other things put up because they're dangerous. It's okay to burn down cities, but it's not okay to march on the Capitol. We live in a very strange time, and of course, the Southern tradition offers examples of how to respond to these things, not violence. But the South has been dealing with this for years, and I want to go to this piece by Tom Hervey on Friday of this week, because the end is just nice. He says, as tempting as it might be to allow such arrogance to drive one to anger or to response in kind, meaning some type of violent response, it would be better if we took the moral high ground upon this matter, refusing any personal affront to the zealous, mistaken young woman, and instead acting with that honor and magnanimous forbearance which ought to characterize the Southern people. It is doubtful the lady would accept any kind overture, but it would still be a magnificent spectacle if a great multitude were made. If every Southern legislator offered a personal tour of the oppressed regions, or 5 million of our people wrote sincere personal invitations to hearth and home, it would be a fine gesture. I doubt we will see the young revolutionary sitting on a porch in a rocking chair sipping tea from a canning jar. But maybe if a decent number of us offered her a personal interview under such circumstances, it would send a message, however small, that we're not the wretched creatures and petty tyrants that she and her kind wrongly imagine us to be. Even if it doesn't, it will at least be in accordance with that sage instruction which the Lord has left for dealing with our enemies in such matters. For as it to a man's glory to overlook an offense and to not repay evil for evil, so also is it that of a people. This is in response to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez saying the South needed to be liberated. Because you see, the South is the great enemy of anything good in society. This is the narrative now coming down from the top of the American government. If you look at the Biden administration, they're not trying to unify America. They're looking to divide America still. I mean, this is why this is the Obama situation. Obama was dividing America. All the things that they're doing are dividing America in a way that for years was said to be evil and unnecessary. And this is why Clyde Wilson asked on Monday, whatever happened to history? What happened to it? He says, according to a recent poll, 72% of Americans think that we are now in the worst period of American history. Polls are dubious things, and the great historian John Lukacs has questioned whether there really is any such thing as public opinion. But this poll simply supports what we already knew about pervasive historical ignorance, which is exhibited every hour, every day by the politicians and the minions of the news media. Americans are a momentary and self-referential people. They can't remember what happened last week unless it was on a soap opera. If you have any notion of ancestors, and even for those of us who cherish our grandchildren, posterity is never thought of. If it is not now, it does not exist. This is an unprecedented situation. In every past civilized society, even common people, had some idea of what their ancestors did in the great events of the past. The past was felt. It was not a theory or a slogan, and they planted trees and built houses that would only be enjoyed by their descendants. I love that line. In every civilized society, every past civilized society, even common people had some idea of what their ancestors did. You know what? There's a reason for that. It's because women were the protectors of the heroic traditions of the past. They passed these things down. You see, what's interesting in the attack on, say, the daughters, United Daughters of the Confederacy, those women were presenting the past, the heroic past of their people to future generations. Now this is called non-history, fake history, fabrication of history, the lost cause. You see, what's going on here is people are attacking the ability for generations to pass down the stories to their posterity. That is evil. Because in no other people in the United States is this required. There's no other people in the United States that faces this same kind of vitriol, the same kind of censorship. No other people. Except for those who want to promote the South. You can be proud of being a Yankee. You can be proud of being descendant from pilgrims. You can be proud of being descendant from a Union soldier. You can be proud of being descendant from any other race of people but Southerners. And you can talk about their heroic deeds and all the things they did, except if your heroes are Stonewall Jackson and Robert E. Lee, which, of course, this is Jackson and Lee week. No. You can't be proud of those people. This is something that, again, Southerners have been dealing with for years. But now it's gone mainstream. And everyone is saying these things. Clyde continues, it does not help, of course, that a great chunk of the American population are foreigners who have no connection to the American past and no interest except in using distorted versions as weapons of extortion. Every people cherishes its own history, which is often somewhat mythical. Are we seeing a new American history for a new American people? Even people with actual American heritage have forgotten who they are and adopted the new history. This is what I just said. Every people cherishes his own history, but now it's used as a weapon. And every history is somewhat mythical. You always have that. The great heroic deeds of people often don't match what actually happened. That's okay, because those great mythical heroic deeds serve as a guide for what people should do in the future. But now we have a new America, and a new American history, and a new American people. Even though having an American people is like having a utopia for utopians. It doesn't exist. So most Americans are not aware of the Revolutionary War, the Civil War, the Great Depression, World War II. These tense times of nuclear standoff in the Cold War. They think today is the worst of times. We, of course, already know of this widespread plain ignorance of the simple facts. The historians are largely responsible for this, especially the current and rising professors who have been teaching distorted, present-centered history for decades now. Teachings would have become the false and ridiculous claims of aggressive minorities and revolutionaries. But the poll tells us more than the widespread ignorance of simple facts of history. The majority, if it is such, who thinks this is the worst of times are not simply ignorant. They have a catastrophic unconsciousness of what has gone before and the fundamentals of how societies of human beings work. They have lost all knowledge of human experience. Thus, imperious childish demands for things that are imaginary or will not work. I would go so far as to say that we are in a post-civilizational era. A large part of the population has dropped out of Western civilization, the highest and brightest human achievement. What's amazing about that is everybody that's in the United States lives in the blessings of Western civilization. The mere fact that they can do what they do and say what they say, the mere fact that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has the status that she has, is only because of Western civilization. The very thing she attacks, the very thing she tries to tear down as being somehow evil and supremacist, she lives in the blessings of that. And that's the danger of all of this. The people that live in the United States, no matter where they're from, live in the blessings of the Anglo-American tradition. And thankfully so. Because if not, we would see things far different here. History, properly understood as the study of the past for knowledge and understanding of ourselves as human beings, has been the unique hallmark of Western civilization. The concept of a meaningful course of human experience does not otherwise exist. We learn some things by scientific examination of ourselves and the world, We have the guidance of Scripture, which is sometimes hard to discern. But all else we really know is the past. The future is a fantasy that nobody can know. We are in the process of losing history and therefore any meaning of our life that is more than just a rapidly passing moment. How many people have gotten interested in history because they wanted to find meaning for what they were experiencing now? They wanted to find meaning. And so much of that in the South, because of defeat and dislocation and poverty, the things that Southerners, white and black, have faced, and a common enemy in those things, and that is centralization. That is the Yankee do-gooderism that has been pervasive since the 1800s, right? I mean, before the war. Yankee do-gooderism. This is a real problem. Because the side effects of that are disastrous. This is when Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez stands up and says, we have to liberate the South. What does she mean by that? Does she mean that people have to be eliminated who don't agree with her? This is what the left thinks. This is cancel culture. This is destructive. I was working on a class for my own McClanahan Academy, and I was reading one of the essays in defense of the Constitution. And it was by a Connecticuter, Oliver Ellsworth, who in fact was a secessionist. But he said something very interesting in one of his essays. It was titled The Landholder, A Landholder, From a Landholder. And the thing that he said, which was so interesting to me, and so poignant for today, I mean, because this is, we're talking about 1787. He wrote this in November of 1787. This is a northerner now, from Connecticut. I loved what he said, because what he said resonates in what the left is doing today. He said this: to censure a man for an opinion in which he declares himself honest and in a matter of which all men have a right to judge is highly injurious. To censure a man for an opinion in which he declares himself honest and in a matter of which all men have a right to judge is highly injurious. So when somebody says something and you censor him for it, but everybody can judge him for it, that's injurious to society. He also says, at the same time, when the opinions even of honorable men are submitted to the people, a tribunal before which the meanest citizen hath a right to speak, they must abide of the consequences of public stricture. When all the meanest people have a right to speak, every meanest citizen hath a right to speak before the people. But when you censor, when you say you can't promote this, you can't do this, you can't say this, when you censor someone, you're taking all this away. This is from 1787. This is a northerner, Oliver Ellsworth. This is what we're doing in America. This is how dangerous things are becoming in America. That's not what the founding generation wanted. They were against all of these things that we're seeing now, but yet they're clothed in this new Americanism under somehow this guise of it's really part of the American tradition to do these things. There has to be a pushback somewhere. Well, how this is going to come and how it's going to happen, I don't know. But when you're looking at censorship, when you're looking at the abridgment of free speech, to judge people, they say something that's wrong, well, you call them out for it, but you don't censor them and you say so they can't say it anymore. We live in a society where it used to be sticks and stones may break my bones, but now it's words will hurt us, right? I mean, words hurt our feelings, so we can't say them anymore. It's ridiculous in where we live, the times we live. I love the piece, too, by Larry Bean, the Reverend Larry Bean, which we published this week. I found it so fun. The old saying, he said, American by birth, Southern by the grace of God, certainly applies to me. I'm an ethnic Southerner who was raised in the North, but who for the past 25 years has lived in the Deep South. In fact, for the past 17 years, I've been so far in the Deep South that it is really barely Southern at all, being south of the South. But we were graciously permitted membership in the Confederacy, given the tolerance and ethnic diversity of that particular manifestation of American Federalism. Moreover, only two other states suffered as long as we did in the so-called Reconstruction, as did Louisiana. So we, my state and my person, have earned the bona fides to consider what it means to be Southern, though perhaps by means of a circuitous route. So permit me to ponder while pondering is still permitted in our reunited states. The South is an embarrassment to many in the various other regions of America, as it's constituted today. We're especially anathema to our betters on the coasts. Indeed, we talk funny. We're slow and dumb and backwards and conservative. We cling to our Bibles and guns. We got Donald Trump elected. That alone should make our separated brethren in the disunited states want to retroactively secede us. Typically, our kids say sir and ma'am, and shockingly, we treat men and women differently. We hold comically to the long-since discredited fantasy that only women bear children. We still put flags and flowers on our ancestral graves, especially those of our veterans, which is apparently why some folks come south for the winter in their black socks and sandals, wagging their heads and honking nasally and incredulously. Look, Martha, these people are still fighting the Civil War. Apparently, we're not enlightened and educated like our brethren from the better regions. We don't read The New Yorker. We don't listen to NPR and watch CNN. We don't care what Whoopi and Joy have to say on The View. We don't realize that we hate our black next-door neighbor, whom we are so deluded as to believe that we actually like, on account of our persistent and systemic white privilege. It is so systemic and persistent that we don't notice it. And we don't know this because we are ignorant, for our children go to Columbia and Stanford. In fact, most of us dropped out of school in the third grade when the book learning began to exceed our cerebral potentiality. It seems that we go about in bare feet and overalls, we spit tobacco all over the place and drop our R's and final G's, we marry our cousins, but only after asking our uncles for their hand in marriage. Moreover, we eat roadkill and still have outhouses. In Louisiana, we speak gutter French and eat bugs. In that sense, we're apparently better than the people of South Carolina who apparently eat dirt. There were experts in the field of judging groups of people and rating them according to their human worth. This is apparently called intersectionality and is taught at Columbia and Stanford. Eating bugs, per se, is good for the environment, and so it's good when we do it, not our betters, of course. The exception is when they come to Bourbon Street to debauch themselves, vomit on the streets, and disrobe publicly, thus providing us locals with a free spectacle. Regardless, many of our fellow Americans mock us and treat us like the drunken uncle sleeping on the couch. Of course, they don't mind when Billy Bob pulls off to the side of the road to help them change a tire, or when thousands of Billy Bobs join the military and fight America's wars. Just so long as we and our filthy kids with mullets don't move next door to them with our truck on blocks and our dog on a chain barking our country music and slaughtering our chickens in our backyards, right? But you dummies had a golden opportunity to be rid of us in 1861 without firing a single shot or spending a dime. You people hate us, but wouldn't let us leave. And you're supposed to be the smart ones? Now you're stuck with us. You created an indivisible nation, and hence you are joined at the hip with the very people that make you roll your eyes in disgust, the ones that cost Hillary Clinton her destiny, the impediments to progress, the ones who make you cry and shriek at the sky and dye your hair various and sundry shades of magenta. And now, in spite of the largest successful program to vilify our region, our culture, and our ancestors, destroy our monuments, rewrite our history, amnesiate even the memory of our memories, Dio Vindice, people, even the belly of the beast of the People's Republic of California, are once again speaking the forbidden word, thinking the unthinkable thought, dreaming the impossible dream, and considering the considerable consideration, secession. So you might just get rid of the people you loathe. Not that there's anything wrong with that. But in spite of y'all's vitriol and opprobrium, you will always, still always, and ever hospitable to all who come to visit. We'll gladly share and some possum stew with y'all, but only after we gather around the old table for prayers and sing Dixie. I have shocking and scandalous news to deliver to my perhaps soon-to-be ex-countrymen, so I do hope you like the smell of irony in the morning. We're all Southerners now. What a great little essay. I mean, because this, again, shows where we are in American society. These people really don't like the South, and anything that can be blamed on the South is going to be bad for America. I wonder if they still hold this against Joe Biden, who was cozying up to Southerners when he was in Congress and had these people as his friends, who used to say Delaware is a Southern state, and he was happy that that people in Delaware actually supported the Confederacy. But no. That's not going to be held against Joe Biden, but it'd be held against anybody else in Washington, if they said these kind of things. We also had a great piece by Phil Lee, a good reason to honor Robert E. Lee, being that it again was Lee Jackson Week. I thought it'd be a good chance to talk about this. This was actually published, I think, January 7th, but we ran it on the 19th. And it's very good. He says, yesterday's melee in Washington provides good reason to honor Robert E. Lee. because he demonstrated how he maintained dignity in defeat while convincing many resentful Southerners to reconcile with their former enemies. At the end of the war between the states in 1865, he had as much reason as any Southerner to reject reconciliation, but he didn't do that. To the contrary, he promoted reconciliation for the sake of the entire country. You see, this is a good place to stop here before I get into the rest of this. Well, again, I've said this on this podcast many, many times. What we're facing today is an attack on reconciliation. There's no reconciliation. There's no unity in the message of the progressives, of the Democrat Party. They don't want reconciliation. They want blood. They want scalps. And we'll see how far it goes. There was an idiotic piece in the Reason magazine. Will the Democrats support imperial presidency? Of course they will, because this is what they want. It's what they always want. It's what Calhoun said every party wanted, was the imperial presidency. He wrote that in the 1830s. Shortly after Lee died in 1870, his family gave biographer J. William Jones personal access to Lee's letters in the family's possession. At this time, Jones wrote, "When I had the privilege of examining his private letter book, I found it literally crowded with letters advising his old soldiers and others to submit to all authorities and become law-abiding citizens." In one letter, Lee wrote, "The interests of Virginia are the same as those of the United States. Its prosperity will rise or fall with the welfare of the country." In an elegy written years later, another Southerner quoted a letter Lee wrote in response to a lady who still cherished her bitterness. "Madam, don't bring up your sons to detest the United States government. Recollect that we form one country now. Abandon all these local animosities and make your sons Americans." Upon accepting the presidency of nearly bankrupt Washington College 4 months after Appomattox, Lee wrote the trustees, "I think it the duty of every citizen in the present condition of the country to do all in his power to aid in the restoration of peace and harmony and in no way to oppose the policy of the state or general government. It is particularly incumbent on those charged with the instruction of the young to set them as an example of submission to authority." A couple of months later, he wrote ex-Confederate General Pierre G.T. Beauregard, "After the surrender of the Southern armies in April, it became my opinion that the duty of every citizen has become to cease opposition and place himself in a position to serve the country. By choosing to dutifully set a personal example, no man could have done more to advance reconciliation among Southerners than had Lee." Union General Grant admitted as much. "Except for a few political leaders, all the people of the South will accept whatever he does as right and will be guided to a great extent by his example." Evidence that Lee was correct is provided by an incident involving antebellum Virginia Governor Henry Wise and his son, who had been a captain in the Confederate Army. Less than 2 months after President Lincoln's assassination, President Andrew Johnson required that former Confederate soldiers take a new Union loyalty oath in order to be granted amnesty, which would be required for them if they wanted to regain property rights. Many ex-Confederates were insulted, believing that their surrender parole terms obviated the need for a new oath. When Captain Wise told his dad that he had taken the oath, the father barked, "You have disgraced the family." His son replied, "But General Lee told me to do it." "No," said the father, "that alters the case. Whatever General Lee says is all right. I don't care what it is." Over a century ago, when historians were more interested in military aspects of the war between the states, one wrote, "Lee took 1 week to defeat McClellan's great army, relieve the siege of Richmond, and reinstall himself as the best-loved hero in the South. Then followed the courses of time, the great battles of Sharpsburg, Fredericksburg, Chancellorsville, Gettysburg, Wilderness, Spotsylvania, Cold Harbor, and Petersburg, in which his matchless leadership thrilled the world. But perhaps the true greatness of the man was more vividly displayed after his surrender at Appomattox, when he said, 'I've led the young men of the South in battle. I've seen many of them fall under my standard. I shall devote my life now to training young men to do their duty in life.'" About 65 years ago, North Carolina author and big game hunter Robert Rourke wrote about Africa's Mau Mau uprising in his novel Something of Value. He excerpted the title from a Batuso proverb: "If a man throws away his traditions, he had better first make certain that he has something of value to replace them." In the wake of the violence during the much of the year of 2020, as well as yesterday in Washington, Virginia Governor Ralph Northam and Richmond Mayor LeVar Stoney have a unique opportunity to promote peace and unity throughout America. Here's how. Permit Lee's statue to remain on Monument Avenue and remove the graffiti. I think this is an interesting point that he made at the end. If you want unity, Biden could have done some things differently. He could have not rescinded the executive order on critical race theory training, which now is going to be challenged in court. He could have been more in favor of Confederate monuments. He could have supported keeping Confederate names on military bases. That really is unity. It's reconciliation, and it's what's needed now. It's not, because what we're seeing is not unity. What we're seeing is the aggressive impulse of one side to defeat the other. something that Americans for years resisted. That is real unity, and that's what is sorely lacking in the American political class. And I think that's where what we're seeing now and moving forward is how it's so important that we get this right and that the Institute continues to publish pieces like this and remind people how important the South is to the American experience. The last piece, I'll just mention it because it's so good, because it does bring up the South and conservatism. I recommend everyone read this article by Duncan Killen, Conservatism in the Southern Tradition. It's a review of Roger Scruton's book, Conservatism, An Invitation to the Great Tradition. And Scruton actually comes down the side that Jefferson essentially was a conservative. And I love this piece. It's because of time. I don't want to read it, but it's so good. And I found it stimulating. And what we're thinking about, what does the South offer for modern society and modern conservative society? And I think it's right in this piece. And that's why everyone should read it. So I hope you enjoyed this week at the Abbeville Institute. Until next time, good day.